Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, all, and welcome to Book Off, the literary podcast with a difference. I'm Joe Haddo, and wherever you are in the world, well, it's great to have you with us. We're in series 12 now. No, I can't believe it either. And want to continue spreading the good word Book Off. So, whether you're a new listener or one of the OGs, we'd absolutely love for you to leave a little review. The best place to do this is on Apple Podcasts. Just search Book Off and click the star rating. And if you feel so inclined, you could even write a few sentences too. Right, enough of the hard sell. It's time to get on with the episode, and today I'm joined by two brilliant authors who'll be going head-to-head in a war of the words a little later on. My first guest is the author of Such a Fun Age, which was a Sunday Times and New York Times bestseller, as well as being longlisted for the 2020 Booker Prize. Her writing has been featured in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Guardian, just to name a few, and she's currently an assistant professor at the University of Michigan. Here to tell us about her new novel, Come and Get It, it's Kylie Reid. Welcome to Book Off.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's lovely to have you here, especially as you've literally just landed and got off the plane.
I did. I'm fresh off the plane.
We feel privileged. And my second guest is also a New York Times bestseller and the host of the award-winning podcast, Sentimental Garbage, another podcaster. She's written two novels for adults, Promising Young Women, and Scenes of a Graphic Nature, as well as a supernatural series for teens. And she's here to tell us about her new novel, sort of new, The Rachel Incident. It's Caroline O'Donoghue. Welcome.
Hi, Joe. How are you?
I'm really well. I paused then because this book has been out quite a while, really, hasn't it?
Yeah.
It came out sort of last summer.
It has, yeah, June.
Yeah.
Okay. So I've got my spiel down pat, don't worry.
you know how to sell this book. Yeah. And yours, Kylie, has just come out.
Just come out about 2 weeks ago.
Yeah. So congratulations.
Thank you.
Well, over the next 30 minutes or so, we're going to be talking about your brilliant novels. As I mentioned, we're going to be finding out what you've been reading and enjoying recently. And of course, we will do the Book Off. That's where each of you gets 3 minutes uninterrupted if you wish to use it to tell us about a book you love and that you think everyone should read. More on that later. Let's talk about The Rachel Incident first. As you said, came out last summer. Mm-hmm. And the book was originally described to me as a messy, funny, addictive novel. You happy with that?
Why not?
I think it was a pretty good sell, to be honest. So it's set in Ireland, 2009. It's after the financial crash. What was it that drew you to that time particularly?
Interesting that you asked that. I think it's funny living in London because I feel like the financial crash was sort of a dimmer concept here. There was I think I said this in the book, but there was the exact same number of jobs available. They just paid people less for them. so like getting into the arts was even harder than it ever was. But in Ireland, it was truly a devastating thing. And myself as a, you know, I was 18 in 2008 when it all happened, and it really felt like the world inverted. Like it was like I had lived in Oz and it became black and white Kansas sort of overnight, in that like the Celtic Tiger, which was a sort of economic phenomenon that made an enormous amount of people middle class in the 80s and 90s, suddenly it all sort of crumbled beneath us. And sort of the recently bourgeois, I suppose, just became, went back to sort of having a working class living overnight. Lots of shops shuttered, lots of opportunities closed to people, kind of on what felt like instantly. And I was 18 at the time. I was living with my best friend and working a part-time retail job, thinking that the world was wonderful and bohemian and extravagant, and it was actually meagre and becoming meagrer by the day. And so I was really attracted to writing about this time as though it were a historical period, because I'm now old enough that it is. And so I think everything that happens in the novel, the choices that are made, no matter how radical or dramatic and sometimes almost melodramatic they become, sort of happen as a result of this, of money and the lack of opportunity suddenly not going around, you know?
I remember I was so selfish, self-centred at that time that I just didn't really...
Where were you living at that time?
London.
Okay.
And I was just getting on with it.
Yeah.
And I didn't, you know, have, I suppose, a personal impact. So therefore I just sort of was getting on with it.
Yeah, well, that's how I feel about right now, right? The whole cost of living crisis, when things are so unbelievably expensive, but I'm just like, well, I'm a well-paid person in the arts, so I'm getting on with it and sort of not observing that there are many, many people suffering and struggling and trying to start their lives with no ability to.
We'll come back to that in a bit, because I want to talk about the different sorts of challenges that different generations face, certainly when it comes to working. But just set up the story of this book for those that won't have read it yet and introduce us to Rachel and James.
So Rachel is a 20-year-old about to graduate with an English degree. And I think that the way I sort of always characterised Rachel is she was probably a joy to teach in class. So that's probably like how she all comes across to people. And she's kind of beginning to realise, as I realised at that time, that the opportunities that she thought she was going to, you know, be able to avail of are now closed to her because of the various pitfalls of the financial crash. Amid all this, she meets James, who starts working with her at the bookshop she works at during the Christmas period of 2010. They instantly fall in love, and he is somebody who is like unbelievably exciting to her. He's like a living novel of a person. He's like been through things. He's closeted, but it's kind of one of these don't ask, don't tell friendships where they both understand he's gay, but we won't be ever discussing it. Rachel also has an enormous crush on her English professor, Dr. Fred Byrne, and because the two of them are so interested in like authoring the soap opera of their own lives, they decide that we're gonna stage a book launch for this sort of like academic book he's got coming out, and you're gonna seduce him at the book launch. And then what actually happens is Dr. Byrne gets off with somebody, but it's not Rachel. And then that sort of happens page 80 or whatever, and then it's kind of everything that gets, is a sort of a drama that unfolds. Incidents ensue.
Incidentally, very good, yes. Seduction at the book launch sounds a bit like a long-lost Agatha Christie or something, doesn't it? Like, we'll pick back up about them and indeed talk further on that friendship in a bit. Kylie, if we could talk about Come and Get It, though. I've seen this book described as a dorm novel, and I'm not sure I've ever seen that before. I assume that means a sort of campus novel, but maybe a bit more claustrophobic.
Right. I think I made the term and I before I really understood what it meant. But here's the thing. I think I reject the term campus novel a tiny bit just because I don't want to lead people astray with this novel. I'm a big fan of a campus novel. I love The Secret History, which I recently reread, which holds up so well. Wow. I loved Prep. I don't know if you consider The Sellout a campus novel, but I love it as well. Really? This is a book that's not into academia at all. And I think when you think of campus novel, you think of the Ivy League, the Ivy on the Walls, the cathedral, the very Victorian-looking place. This is not that. This is at the University of Arkansas, a state school. I'm obsessed with normalcy and normal characters, and that was what I was going for here. Also, it's very claustrophobic. This mostly happens within a dorm.
Yeah. So actually, it's the perfect description in some ways. You've coined a new...
I love that.
I would really hope that someone else was like, oh, I'm going to do a dorm novel, because
I would
read
so.
It.
Yeah. And they'll all credit you.
That's perfect.
So as you said, it's set at the University of Arkansas. It's 2017. Was that informed by your own experience of teaching at a university now, or is that not where it came about?
Definitely. It was doubly connected. I don't enjoy writing about myself, but I'm very inspired by where I live and what my work is. I've had a lot of jobs too. I think I counted one day and I think I have about 50 jobs in my
20s. 50?
I think so.
Wow.
I was a hostess. I worked in retail. I was a magician's assistant for a second.
Which were you worst at?
Worst at? Oh God. I worked at a restaurant, Weber's, which is like a famous restaurant in New York City for a weekend. And one of the very seasoned waiters yelled at me and that was it. And I didn't come back and they didn't call me. It was like a very solid break. It was very bad.
Did you cry?
I didn't cry, but only because I was in public. Like, you know what I mean?
If anyone shouts at me for any reason, it's just like, here they come, here they tears.
Yep. If anyone had said to me, like, are you okay? I would have had a breakdown, but I didn't. There were a few others I was very bad at, but...
Can I return to the magician's assistant?
Yes.
Just for a moment, because... What?
Yeah, you know what? I did it for maybe 8 weeks, and I got sawed in half and everything, and it paid pretty well.
Yeah.
I remember I made something like $90 for a 2 or 3 hour show. I went into a box and it like made me hot or whatever. I'm doing quotes around that, which I think I was like wearing dorky glasses and I just took them off and had like a leotard on.
No.
I did that for about 8 weeks since in college. Yeah, I've had a lot of jobs. So that's definitely what inspires me. So I was an RA, which I know is not a super familiar job here, or it's becoming more familiar, which is a resident assistant. It's a glorified, underpaid babysitter, student organizer, leader person who's in charge of a floor on a dorm. So I did that for 1 year. And then I lived in Fayetteville, Arkansas for a year as well, from 2016 to 17. So both of those together inspired the world of this novel.
Got it. Right. Could you just set up the story then of this book and introduce us to your characters?
Absolutely. So Come and Get It is about three very different women who all come to Fayetteville, Arkansas in order to get three very different things. There's Millie, our protagonist, and she wants to be a grown-up. She wants to have these layers of adulthood that say that she's moved on from school because she's had a couple setbacks. She wants to buy a house and get a job and have friends. Those are her goals. Then we have Agatha Paul. She's a visiting professor from DePaul University. She's just had a breakup with her wife, and she wants to get over it. She wants to splurge a little bit and have a year that doesn't count, a bit of a rumspringa. And then there's Kennedy, who is a transfer student from the University of Iowa, and she's got a dark secret and she wants to start over. So all of these women come and collide into each other. And I would say that this is a novel about desire, consumption, and buying things. Yeah.
Yes. Very good. Okay. Yes. Pretty good for having just got off a plane, to be honest.
Yeah.
You've sold it.
Thank you. I had lots of time to think while I wasn't sleeping.
Yes, so when you weren't sleeping.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. I want to talk about friendships, actually, because friendships run very deep, don't they? They can be incredibly intense, especially in stories. And I feel like capturing a friendship is quite a thing to do. And thinking of Rachel and James, Caroline, and how fragile they could be, almost. And I don't know whether we get those types of relationships as much in novels or on screen as we do the sort of romantic love. Would you agree with that?
I think traditionally you're correct, but I think it's beginning to change. I'm noticing in the beginning to change that, like, friendships and platonic relationships between women are not necessarily platonic, but like I was a huge fan of the relationship between the babysitter and the employer in your book, that kind of sort of freelance, unofficial, money under the counter relationship that I mean, I never consciously, but I think there's a little bit of that in the Rachel incident as well. I do think that we're moving towards depicting friendship more and more in art and in books, because I think the generation of writers who are coming of age now, sort of millennial authors, are in general having children much later, which means the instinct to write family novels or couple novels or relationship novels is being dwarfed by friendship novels, simply because our friendships are becoming are more important to us for longer in our lives. Like, I think about my life, I'm 33, 34 in a month. And, you know, I see my friends two nights a week at least, kind of thing. Mm. And my mother wasn't doing that at my age. She was raising four kids. And so they're necessarily, I think, those relationships become more important, but also more loaded, more frighted, and they have to buttress more expectation and more hurt, you know? So I think it's becoming a much richer thing than it used to be, And I also think that, like, we're used to seeing in rom-coms of, like, oh, the best friend with no internal life. Yeah. And now people are obsessed with the best friend with the large internal life,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah, very much so. And in the sort of campus novel, dorm novel genres, you know, friendships are such a big part of those, because in university you kind of find your friends, but they're not necessarily who you'd actually want to be friends with. And maybe you learn a little bit, like, at school and stuff, after a while you're like, oh, actually these aren't necessarily my people, right?
Right. Yeah, that's, I mean, you go into school, one of the biggest fears is like, will I make friends here? And I remember when I started school at the University of Arizona, and then I transferred to the Marymount Manhattan College, and I remember telling myself over and over, be friends with people because they can introduce you to other friends as well. And that way of thinking, I think, is good. You should be open to other opportunities, but it is a bit networky and a bit usey, you know, like as if friendships are currency. And that was definitely something I wanted to achieve in this novel. There's people who want friends desperately and then find themselves emulating their friends, and how much is too much of taking things from friends. Something I think is interesting, but it kind of goes along with what you were talking about, is I can only speak for the States, but within the culture of work, which I'm super interested in, there's so much of the people who you work with becoming your very close friends. And I think that that's more and more because, at least in the States, so many offices want you doing everything at work. And when you watch TV, it's like they're always at work. They're always with the people that they work with. I used to work at an office that had haircuts at work.
Whoa.
It was disgusting. Why are you cutting hair?
Yeah, for you.
Yeah, and I had to organize it and everything. And they had happy hours. And on the weekend, there were like these sleepovers and people would stay late. And they wanted you at the office all the time. And so those friends at work become like almost too close. Like you see them more than you're actually seeing your family. And that's something that really interests me. Jobs where you kind of sleep where you work a little bit. That's something I wanted to fool with, and what that does to friendships.
Yeah. And that's, it's very much those kinds of jobs. And I've worked at like advertising agencies that had that sort of vibe before. It is an extension of like a campus effect. They want everyone to feel like they're in like an undergrad almost.
Exactly. You know? People were wanting laundry services. We had massages at this office I worked at. People would come in and take a shower. It was like a different home. And then I think that you see other people there and you're like, oh, this person's like my friend slash family. And yeah, things get a little confusing.
It is nuts, isn't
it? Yeah, it's very strange.
But it's almost like that when everyone started learning about, around the turn of the century, about like the Google office culture and like, oh, they have all this stuff there and go-karts and lectures and everything. And the kind of trickle down from the public knowledge of that has been like ordinary advertising agencies having like free tacos on a Wednesday or whatever.
It's bizarre.
I watched the WeWork documentary.
Any good?
I loved it, actually. I haven't seen the adaptation, but I watched the sort of the whole, you know, revealing of it. I think it's called The Making and Breaking of a $1 million Unicorn. I can't remember what it's called now, actually. But it's interesting hearing you talk about that, because part of that documentary is it was, people say it was becoming almost like a cult, because you were working there, sleeping there, socializing there, exactly as you were saying, Kylie, like doing your laundry there and shout. And it's like, where's the separation here? Yeah. And like, are these people your friends? Like, you know, it's a really good documentary if you have the time to watch it. It's really fascinating.
Yeah. But on the flip side, though, in defense of that, because it is easy to be like very judgmental about those work cultures. But I remember working in this advertising agency from the age of 23 to 26, and not as an immigrant to this country and not knowing really anyone in the city. It was an amazing ready-made social group. And like, I met my husband there and some of my best friends there, and most of those people I'll never speak to again. But I feel very grateful for those years, for it just being sort of a safety net and having that sort of university feel to it, you know? Yeah.
Well, because speaking of jobs, as I mentioned earlier, every generation has their own sort of different struggle. The work-life balance is different. The path to work, the expectations of work, etc. As I mentioned, the book is set in 2009. And for millennials entering the workplace post-recession, I was here in London with my blinkers on because I had a job. But it was quite a difficult time for knowing sort of like what maybe what you thought you wanted to do wasn't suddenly as easy as you thought it was going to be, right?
Yeah.
Is that something you thought about when you were writing this?
Definitely. I feel like, so Rachel, the character, is she's somebody who really did assume that a path would always be open to her. Her parents are these two cosmetic dentists who sort of invested all of their money in various properties and businesses that then failed as a result of this recession. Mm. And so she is trying, she's experiencing this thing of class regression in that, you know, she's, and it's also that, that fun difference between, not fun, but like the difference between broke and poor. So she lives with, she lives in this sort of share house with her friend James. And James is from like a near criminal poverty where his family grew up in like council estates in Manchester and his dad was in and out of prison. His parents were addicts. But then sort of later in life, his mum met like a rich farmer, moved to Ireland, and he's sort of been living a quite bougie pocket money type existence via his mum, who just wants to look after him now that she can. And so you have these two characters in a house, one of whom is broke but not poor, one of, the other is poor but not broke. And I find that a really fun thing to rub up against mm-hmm. each other, because even though they are the best of friends, and we know throughout the book, because it's set in the present day where Rachel is looking back at this incident of her life, she's getting texts from her best friend who James who lives in New York still, and they're still clearly in contact. But what I became interested in is not like, you know, is more like, how do we stay friends with people despite the things they have done to us? And James has done terrible things to her, and she has done terrible things to James, and a lot of it has stemmed from this key difference of one person being broke but not poor, and another mm-hmm. person being poor mm-hmm. but not broke.
Yeah, it's so fascinating. And actually, Kylie, you mentioned talking about your new novel, you know, it's partly about consumption. And I think we should talk about money, because it is a big theme. You look at people who have it, who don't, and there's always questionable decisions that come up, you know, or are made because of money. What was it that drew you to this particularly for the book, or is the sort of backbone of this book?
I've always been interested in talking about money. I think it is just this.
This is a great guest pairing, by the way. Yes. Clearly, we're obsessed with money.
It is this force that runs our lives and dictates where we work, who we date, what we wear, the food we eat, how it's made. And I love attacking it from different perspectives. Within this novel, I was really interested in the consumption factor of money and what we buy to symbol and like evoke other thoughts that people have about us. Millie, on a very simplistic level, a house represents her growing up and fixing these 2 years that she's had in college that she feels like she got set back because she was taking care of her mother. She was earning in-state tuition, and a house would do that thing for her. Agatha is someone who finds herself paying women to behave a certain way or to keep her secrets, and she has a lot of money, and she finds herself in this predicament where she doesn't like the way that she's giving it to other people. Kennedy might be the most interesting perspective in terms of money, because she is very politically unfussy and she believes that she doesn't have a strong relationship to money. But when she is upset, when she feels like she's going to have a panic attack, she finds herself at Target just picking up a little thing here or there. I think that most people can relate to the little temperamental joy of, I'm just going to go pick up a few things really quickly. And that is super fascinating to me. What goes off in us and what chemically happens to us when we're buying a little tiny thing. I opened this novel with an epigraph from Lucy Biederman's book of poetry spells, almost, called Walmart Book of the Dead. And I'm not going to say the line properly, but it says, I don't want to spend eternity with the lights off. I want to buy the brightest lights with my Amex. And there was just something about that that evoked what I wanted to talk about with consumption, this tsunami of stuff that we want to surround ourselves with. And the dorm, going back to your first question, was the perfect place to talk about stuff in that way, these dorm room essentials that apparently you need. I wanted to focus on young women building up their personalities in this time as they're separating themselves from their parents for the first time, and what the items they want to surround themselves with say about their person.
What were yours? What
were mine? Yeah. Oh, man. I think I had a cork board that I like wanted to put stuff up there, so if people came in, they'd be like, oh, she's like a social person. There's like a ticket stub. Mm-hmm. She has friends. That's great. I wanted a Marc Chagall poster. What's the famous? The Eye in the Village. That very famous like horse.
Oh, yeah. Photo. Yeah, yeah.
But then when I went and got it, it was mislabeled, and I got a Marc Chagall poster called The Birthday instead, but I liked it and I paid for it, so it sat on my wall for two years, so I had that. I'm trying to think of what I definitely had the lights, mm-hmm. the string lights.
Yep.
That seemed really important at the time. And pictures, I believe. Did you have a dorm room?
No, but we didn't really have dorms in Ireland. It's not really a thing.
Gotcha.
But it was more like having a share house, really.
Okay.
But my thing was very much stacks and stacks of CDs. Like, look how into music I am.
Yes, yes. I'm very cultured. Here's all my stacks. Let me put these out. Fiona Apple was a big one for me. That CD had a big effect.
I just bored everyone with my Fiona Apple rendition at a karaoke night.
Which one did you do, Criminal?
No, Paperback.
Oh, Paperback's so good. That's
great. I'd say, no, nothing against Fiona Apple, by the way, but that was just interesting choice for karaoke, I'd say, no?
Yeah, no, it was a karaoke night in my own home.
Okay, fine.
So I was sort of said to...
House rules.
We were doing all the classics, and I said, everyone, I want everyone to perform the song of their heart, and it doesn't have to matter.
Very good.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, oh, I like that.
Yeah, I thought it was nice.
Yeah, the CDs I can relate to had DVDs as well because I wanted people to see all my art house films and my French cinema.
Yes.
And then pictures, as you said, I just covered the walls like straight blue tack on the wall. Look at all the fun things I've done before I've come here.
Exactly. Yeah. I don't need you guys. I have all of this stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you're here. That's cool. But look at all the friends I've got back home. It's just it's hilarious thinking about it now. But like it just felt so normal. Just felt so like that's what I have to do in this room. So it is fascinating. Before we move on, I do want to ask if there's any news about your screen adaptation. Are we allowed to know anything? Maybe there's nothing to know.
These things take so long. And I feel that so many people in 2019, 2020 who had their things optioned had a big falling out because of the pandemic and then of course the strike as well.
Yes.
So all I can say right now is it is still very much in play. We have a wonderful team and I'm crossing my fingers because I'm very excited about what we're creating. That's all I can say.
Okay, we'll take it.
Yeah.
That's fine. Thank you. A very good answer. Yeah.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I always like to ask my guests what they've been reading and enjoying recently. This can be something new that you've picked up, a brand new author you've discovered, or something that's, you know, been out for 30 years and you've only just got around to it. Caroline, is there anything you've been enjoying recently?
I just started this weekend The Unconsoled by Kazuo Ishiguro.
Oh.
And do you know what? I'll be so interested to see whether I finish it because it is it's his book that came out after The Ruins of the Day, and he recently had like a reissue of all of his back catalogs, and even on the back of this book it says reviled in its time. Wow. So people hated it. So he obviously had this beautiful, taut little novel about a butler and that everyone adored, and I think won the Pulitzer the year it came out. And then he followed it up with a 500-page book that is very much... I hate when people compare books to things that aren't books. Like, mm-hmm. I hate when people are like, for fans of Fleabag with a book. Right. But this book, is like, it just feels like a David Lynch movie in that everything follows a kind of a strange dream logic. And what it is about is this world-famous pianist called Ryder, who shows up in some central European town because he believes he's there to play a concert or whatever. And then I'm only about 100 pages in, but the longer he's there, the more he realizes that, like, something, they expect something more from him than simply a piano recital. Everyone he meets, from like the porter in the hotel to like the manager to, like, everyone he meets seems to like want something very specific from him that they can't, he can't quite give to them. Like, for example, the hotel porter comes up to him in the cafe in this hotel and says, "You need to go find my daughter in town and ask her about her life." And it's such a strange, odd, quite disquieting book to read, even though nothing necessarily horrifying is happening. But why it's so fascinating to me is obviously he's a beautiful writer, but also it clearly is a novel that has happened to someone after they have become instantly very famous, probably in his like mid to late 30s at that point. You know, he's got a young family or whatever, and now he's touring all over the world with this incredibly famous book, and everyone seems to want something from him that he can't give. Mm-hmm. And as a sort of a psycho, sort of subconscious sort of exploration of that, it's fascinating.
Wow.
But it is 500 pages long. It has no internal logic. So whether I will finish it, I don't know, but I respect it hugely.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Gosh, I genuinely am quite interested in that.
Yeah.
Have you read The Buried Giant?
No, I haven't. I'm working my way from the start with Kaz at the moment.
Fab. Okay, because his latest one, or the most recent one, was called Clara and the Sun.
Yeah.
And it is absolutely beautiful, and it is a wonderful, wonderful, in my opinion, novel. And it's quite simple, and I don't mean that in a negative way to Itch. That it's just quite a simple novel, and yet obviously it's not, because there's so much under the surface. Whereas The Buried Giant is so strange and weird and haunting that I think people hated it, you know, just because they didn't know what to do with this thing. They didn't.
Totally.
I love it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm going to maybe, you said it's called The...
The Unconsoled.
Unconsoled. I have not read that one.
Yeah. So I might, well, apparently very few people have.
Well, yeah. Oh God, I'd love to be like reviled. That was, I've done something well if I'm
exactly.
Reviled,
there were contemporary reviews that said, has he lost his mind?
That's the dream.
Yeah.
People think that you're a little bit off. Yeah. Yeah,
that's great. Yeah. That's what we're all sort of striving to for like books in the future now. We want that quote. Thank you for that recommendation. What about you, Kylie? What have you been reading and enjoying recently?
Mostly, I have to say, be honest and say that mostly I read student work right now. Thesis projects and first chapters and workshop and everything. But just now, when I was having insomnia on a plane, honestly, okay, I listened to The Bluest Eye by Toni Morrison earlier this year, which she narrates herself, and it really knocked me out. Uh-huh. And so on the plane, I thought, I love her voice so much, I'm going to start Sula and maybe it'll put me to sleep. It was so good. I listened to the first half. I did not sleep at all. I know I will finish it. It's just gorgeous. And
it's her, did you say?
It's her.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
I didn't know she did her own books. It's amazing.
Yeah, wow.
They're incredible. And I like a book where you don't know where it's going, but you don't care.
Yeah.
And that's the first half of Sula. So I'm definitely finishing that one. Other than that, I have a little baby daughter at home. And so I feel very passionate about good children's books.
Yes.
Because there's so many bad ones. Oh my God. They're just, at the end is like, and that is why you should go to bed when your mom tells, and it's just like, you don't have to make it all a morality tale all the time. And there is an artist, Gayo Fujikawa, and her books are incredible. They're just kind of like a fever dream for toddlers.
Oh,
there's one called Sleepy Time, and it starts off with like, this is what happens when you get sleepy. And then it's like, this is how some animals sleep. These animals sleep in the day. Anyway, bye. Like, it's just like a picture of sleep. And there's one called Babies, which my baby is obsessed with. She can't get enough. One called Baby Animals. And there's one, this is so strange, There's one that's out of print, and I went to go get it, and it was like $60, and it's called Millie's Secret. And the main character of my book is Millie, and I was like, I feel like she's speaking to me. I did not drop $60. I might one day.
One day, maybe. One day,
yeah.
And just remind me of the author's name.
Their name is Gyo, G-Y-O, Fujikawa.
Fujikawa.
And the drawings are just really beautiful.
Wow. Okay, brilliant.
Yeah.
I love good children's books. Okay. I'm always on the hunt for a good children's book. Thank you both for those recommendations, and it's time for another, because it's time now for The Book Off, where each of you is going to get 3 minutes uninterrupted to tell us about a book that you love and you think we should all read. This can be anything at all. I never use the words favourite book. I think that's an impossibility. It's like saying favourite album. I mean, I know Fiona Apple will probably be high up on your lists, but, you know, mine would change every day. Similarly, if you ask me a favourite book today, it'll change tomorrow. So this is just a book that you love and think everyone out there should read at some point. We've got to do a little bit of admin before we get into it. Now, we always say the person that's travelled the furthest gets to decide if they go first or second.
Me.
That is undoubtedly you this time, Kylie. So would you like to go first or would you like to go second?
Second.
Okay.
Okay.
She's putting you up first. And as I said, Caroline, you get 3 minutes uninterrupted.
Okay.
If you're still talking, though, at the 3 minutes, we will interrupt you and you get to decide with what. That's either the school bell or the horn.
That horn is on its last legs, I'd say.
Actually, I think it was just, I think it's just a weak operator. Hold on.
I'll take the horn.
Okay, right.
That was
I'm
punchy.
I'm giving it a proper squeeze now. Okay, fantastic. I'm going to put 3 minutes on the clock then. And just before we start it, tell us the book that you're putting forward, please.
Piranesi by Susanna Clarke.
Oh, fabulous. All right. 3 minutes over to you to tell us about Piranesi.
So Piranesi by Susanna Clarke is a book that I went in thinking was one thing and turned out to be completely the other. So I picked up both of her novels, Doctor Strange and Mr. Strange. You know the one, Narelle Strange, whatever.
That one, yeah.
That one and Piranesi to go on a holiday last year. And I read both of them. And it's like the best way to absorb her work is like just in one big, huge chunk. And what happens with Piranesi is it opens and you're convinced that it's going to be this like prose poetry kind of department of speculation, like just flow with the beauty of the language and it will take you where you want to go, which is generally the way I do not read at all. I can't read that way. But once you start like listening to what it's saying and taking it quite at its face value, you understand that it's like actually a very tight mystery crime novel with very strange language in it. And so the plot of it is that Piranesi is this kind of impish man who lives in the house, and the house is this endless sort of temple-like building full of vestibules and statues, and that like the tides come in every now and then. It's kind of this liminal place within worlds that is full of like basically all the ideas and concepts of our world somehow get transmuted onto statues in his. And it is the most like strange thing, and you think like, oh, of course, this is Susanna Clarke having fun with a metaphor or whatever. But then you realize this man who is such an adorable narrator and so funny and so wonderful to spend time with on the page. He is stuck in this place. He was kidnapped and he was put there. And it goes on, it's sort of the sort of prose poetry style of like, I live in the house and I go visit the 17th vestibule in the north wing and blah, 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 in the year of the albatross. And it's that language begins to peel away. And then this kind of very pacey contemporary thriller starts to catch up with it. I am in all of the book. I have not been able to stop thinking about it. I read it first and now I'm listening to an audiobook because I just love the vibe of it. And it's read by Chiwetel Ejiofor, which is wonderful as well. And I love the majesty of it. I love feeling that book fall over me. I think it's incredible. And that's it.
Wow.
Yeah.
Fab.
That's great.
Get a bit of honking anyway. 2 minutes, 15 seconds. Didn't need
it. Oh, wow.
Didn't need the extra very 45. Nice. Absolutely love that. Thank you for the pitch. We'll come back and talk about Piranesi very shortly, but you can have a rest and have a sip of water because it's...
I was eating so much time not being able to remember Doctor Strange and Mr. Norrell. No, Jonathan Strange and Mr. fucking Norrell.
You got there.
Yeah.
Finally. We knew what you meant.
Yeah.
I couldn't think of it either.
Yeah.
Cool. Right. You get a little rest. Kylie, it's over to you. You've got 3 minutes on the clock. And just before we start, tell us the book you're putting forward, please.
All right. I'm going to talk about Disgrace by J.M. Coetzee. And I'm glad that you brought up not favorites, because this isn't my favorite book, but this book is doing something I really greatly admire. So right now I'm teaching a class called The Workplace Novel. So I'm ingesting everything workplace. And so that's why I picked this up. I am not teaching this in my class because it wasn't what I was looking for in terms of work, but it did something else that really inspired me. So this is a book about David Lurie. He's a professor in South Africa in his early 50s. And after an inappropriate tryst with one of his students, he is, in a word, disgraced. So he doesn't want to apologize. He doesn't really want to fight for his job. And after he is dismissed from his position, he moves to the countryside to live with his adult daughter, Lucy, who I think is in her late 20s or early 30s. But the novel takes off a bit from this point, kind of like Caroline's, in a way that you didn't think it was going. I love books that put you in the position of the character, and like David Lurie, you truly have no idea what's coming next for him in this part of his life. But it's then that the novel really spectacularly deals with the aftermath of the South African apartheid and imperialism. And there's a home invasion, there's a sexual assault, and there's other violent acts, and the word disgrace becomes colored in a lot of other kind of connotations. So one thing I love is the writing moves. I have pulled pieces to show my students that when they're writing, they don't have to have everyone in their novels like packing their bags up or leaving the restaurant. You can just go. You can just go to the airport. You can just go and the reader will trust you. And I think he does that really well. The prose is really gorgeous. It's a mix between idealism and realism, which is really apropos of the theme as well. But there's two big things that I like most about this piece. The first is that the main character remains his unlikable self while still taking an emotional journey through the novel. I think a lot of people think that your character needs to get better or learn something, and that is just unfortunately not how we operate for the most part. It's incredibly realistic, and he comes out not better or worse, but having entered into a new phase of himself, not exactly morally altered. I like my novels the same way I like my children's books, no morality tale at the end. The second is the most important, though, and it's what I want to achieve in my novels. Tayari Jones talks about not writing about problems people, but writing about people's problems. Disgrace has a really great way of showing the downstream effects of the apartheid on a man who you think would be completely removed and protected by his race and career standing. It's not a work of polemics. It's a piece of art that sets itself up with Lucy, a young woman who's on one opinion, and her father who's on another. And therefore, it sets itself up to not have a singular politic, which I really enjoy. Jesmyn Ward does this really well with the background of Hurricane Katrina and Salvage the Bones. And it's something I really want to do with my writing. For me personally, I understand a political moment in history when a writer gets extremely granular just to one character. So they're not saying, oh, this is how it is for everyone. It's just this one person. I see the bell coming. I'm done.
Oh, that was fantastic.
I actually am done. Person. Okay.
Oh, wow.
I thought there was, I was so, felt so awful.
No, yeah. No, I love rules. Especially
Oh, fabulous pitch as well. I love Disgrace. Just think it's
a strange, great novel.
A strange, great novel it is. Mm-hmm. Won the Booker, didn't it?
It won sure
the Booker
did.
I think it was published in 1999, so I think it won the 2000 Booker, yeah. Ooh, we'll come back, talk about Disgrace. You can have a rest now. two fabulous pictures, two very different books. And I loved you talking about Piranesi, and I love the fact that you went in thinking one thing, which so often can happen with a great book, and you think, yeah, I kind of know what this is going to be, and I'm here for it. And then you're
and so oddly
flipped.
Proud of myself for even picking it up at all, being like, look at all this obtuse language and all the things she's not telling me and all the random capitalizations of I can read poems.
It's the sort of book I'd have had on my shelf, you know, at university.
Yes. Like, look. It will 100% be that book for so many people.
But as you said, it becomes this tight mystery novel,
yeah,
sort of not out of nowhere but unexpectedly. And some of the I just loved the way that you were describing you love the majesty of it. What a lovely thing to say about a book, and that makes me think, oh yeah, like I want to be in it.
Yeah, and for such a slim book, right? Yeah. I think it's, you know, 250 pages or something, and to like summon that much kind of grandeur with so few pages is incredible. And like, I hate that Susanna Clarke has only written two full novels, but they're both perfect novels. Mm, and like, one of them is 1,000 pages long. One of them is 200 pages long. It's like, go off, queen.
Yeah. Thank you. Thanks very much. Are you getting something out of it a second time from listening to it?
Yes, because I'm not waiting to get it. You know what I mean? Because the mastery of the plotting has come to me this time around. Because as I keep saying, the first 30 pages when I first read it, I was so proud of myself for reading something so prosaic that I was just trying to get through it. And then the mystery started revealing itself to me. But now that I can see on the second go around that this mystery is threaded in from page one, sentence one kind of thing, yeah. It's made me really admire her even more as a craftsperson. And I'm also very fascinated whenever, because I think so many adults, it's funny, I was listening to, I think, Graham Norton on the podcast recently, on his podcast, and he was saying about how he was reading Kindred by Octavia Butler and how he would never read fantasy or sci-fi ever. And I love reading fantasy and sci-fi, and it's so curious to me when so few adults will give it any quarter at all. Even people who absolutely adore books like Graham Norton does. And the few things that managed to break through into adult fantasy, into being a book that everyone reads. And for some reason, Susanna Clarke has been anointed as one of those people where, like, literary people will read her work because, again, she's only made two books and that's that's enough for
Maybe that's the key.
Maybe that's the key. She also has a book of short stories, but you know what I mean?
Two novels.
Yeah.
Two novels. And then that's fine. Then you can break in.
Yeah, yeah.
To the literary world.
I think what literary people resent is, like, fantasy authors who tend to write a lot. And so they have, like, you know, like your Robin Hobb or whatever.
Oh, I love Robin Hobb.
Yeah. But literary people don't because they're like, 9 books? I can't impress people with that.
What do you mean 3 trilogies? What are you talking about?
3 trilogies.
And some of them are fat as well.
Yeah.
I loved hearing you talk about that. So thank you very much for that wonderful pitch. And thank you too, Kylie, for talking about Disgrace. I think I read Disgrace originally too young. And then I picked it up again about 5 years ago and reread it. And it was that time that I was like, oh, I get it.
Ah, there you go.
Because it is, I think you need to have a bit of life under you to really get the book, I think, or to certainly get why it's okay that, as you put, he doesn't come out any better or worse and he's still the same person.
Still the same. I see that. If I was younger, I think I would have said, so what did he learn and what is this saying? And I really reject the idea of reading a book like a book report and you're trying to understand things. And this is a book that has so many different angles on one event that affects them on such a personal level. I don't want to spoil the book for anyone.
No, we mustn't.
So difficult. But the morality of your position as one singular person within a huge political context is called into question, I think, in a really genius way here. And I also have to say that the main character, his unlikability is very charming. He's very selfish and rude and sees the world in such a strange light. When people say, oh, I need to root for someone in a novel, I don't really share that. And I also don't actually believe that that's what people really want all the time. We love disgusting people. We watch Succession and Game of Thrones, and they're all terrible all the time. I think that Coetzee is one of those people that can make really charming, awful people.
Yeah.
I'm curious, with your students, do you feel like they lean towards wanting to like characters? I know it's a criticism that's often put on young readers.
I think that they feel that responsibility for sure. And with Come and Get It, I gave a coworker, a great reader, my book very early on. And she had warned me about my main character going into perfect protagonist area. Mm. And I'm really glad she did so I can pull them and twist them a little bit. I do think that students feel a little bit of pressure to have a likable character, but more pressure to have a theme. I think that, you know, when you're listening to other authors talk all the time, you're like, oh, they're talking about the themes of their book, so I need to have those be really clear in my book. But I do not personally think that you can theme your way into a novel. I think you have to get obsessed with characters, and those things will come out on their own. I think you just need to get super granular.
I think that what's interesting is that because so many authors have a voice now because of podcasts like this or whatever, there's almost like a separate roadshow that goes on when you talk about the books, and themes are a great way to help you talk about a book and sell a book, but they're not actually what you go into the book to prove.
No,
and so people are believing the magic trick, and they kind of need to get behind the trick a bit more. You know,
totally. And I think it's difficult because, well, I also think so many authors like get really like big picture and they're like, oh, I really wanted to explore the depths of blah, blah, blah. But personally, I can only speak for myself. Yeah. Sometimes I'm just like, oh, this thing is kind of interesting. Let me read about it. Let me figure that out a little bit more. And I think just being intrigued by
or just being like, dorms, that'd be a fun setting.
Exactly. Kind of thing. Yeah. That is a totally fine place to operate from. Like as long as your characters are having like an emotional journey, like at some point, that's fine with me.
But I recall, and it was 6 years ago now or whatever the last time I read Disgrace, but as I recall, it's not... It doesn't go into too... Like, you mentioned that he doesn't describe the picking of a bag to go to the whatever,
Never.
But... And I don't seem to really recall much about the house. I kind of remember a bit of the landscape because it's out in the country. But it's not Spartan yet. The novel is in my head still. You know, I don't need those details to remember the story and indeed picture him and Lucy. And so, it's interesting because... I don't think he is a detail writer necessarily.
I don't think so either. It definitely gets under the skin. I love when novels kind of fold back over themselves and do what the novel is doing to you. And there's an assault that he's circling around and not talking about with characters in the book. And then the novel is kind of talking about imperialism without mentioning it to you as well and the effects. And I think it's really well done.
Yeah, I loved it. And I loved both of these pictures. I thought they were fab. But I've got to choose one. So that's the game.
I've got to choose one.
I mean, you know, that's sort of the thing, the jeopardy I've set up for myself. I'm going to take Disgrace.
Well done.
I feel like you just did it because I traveled so far. But I'm going to take the win. Yes.
No?
Yes. I think that's what happened.
What do you mean? What? Because you've been on a plane and you landed at 6 a.m. and then you came straight here.
And you're leaving your infant daughter to be here.
I did. Not at all. Not at all.
It's not a competition. I just won, you know?
Yeah, sure, exactly. Yeah.
No, I feel very comfortable losing to that.
Well, also, it's, there's no loser really, because I think any opportunity to talk about a book that you love that others might be listening and think, I want to read that, that's a win. Isn't it? A win-win. So thank you both for those fab recommendations. And here's two more for you. Come and Get It by Kylie Reid, which is out now. It's published by Bloomsbury. And The Rachel Incident by Caroline O'Donoghue. It's also out now. It's published by Virago, and they are both brilliant reads. Kylie, Caroline, what a pleasure to spend this time with you. Thank you very much for being on Book Off.
That was lovely.
Thank you. That was great.
Really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.